their best to hold the right posture. "You, woman," the guard said, pointing at Fail. "A Saldean, eh?" He laughed. "I thought a Saldean woman would kill a man before letting him take her captive." He shoved Fail on the shoulder. Alvar held his breath. Oh, blood and bloody ashes. Lady Fail wasn't going to be able to take that. The guard was looking to see if the captives were really beaten down or not. Fail's posture, her manner, would give her away. She was noble and— Fail slumped down, becoming small, and whimpered a reply that Alvar could not hear. Alvar found himself gaping, then forced his mouth shut and looked down at the ground. How? How had a lady like Fail learned to act like a servant? The guard grunted. "Go on," he said, waving to Aravine. "Wait there until we send for you." The group shuffled to a patch of ground nearby, where Aravine ordered everyone to sit down. She stood to the side, arms folded, tapping one toe as she waited. Thunder rumbled, and Alvar felt an odd chill. He looked up, and into the eyeless face of a Murdral. A shock ran through Alvar, like he'd been dropped into an icy lake. He couldn't breathe. The Murdral seemed to glide as it moved, its cloak motionless and dead as it rounded the group. After a horrible moment, it moved on back toward the supply camp. "Searching for channelers," Fail whispered to Mandevwin. "Lord help us," the man whispered back. The wait was nearly insufferable. Eventually, a plump woman in white clothing strode up and wove a gateway. Aravine barked for them all to climb to their feet, then waved them through. Alvar joined the line, walking near Fail, and they passed from the land of red soil and cold air to a place that smelled like it was on fire. They entered a ramshackle camp, filled with trollocs. Several large cookpots boiled nearby. Just behind the camp, a slope led up sharply to some kind of large plateau. Streams of smoke rose from the top of it, and from there and somewhere to Alvar's left could be heard the sounds of combat. Turning away from the slope, the boy saw the darkened outline of a tall, narrow mountain far in the distance, rising from the flat plain like a candle in the middle of a table. He looked back up the slope behind the camp, and his heart leaped. A body was plummeting down from the top of the slope, still clutching in its hand a banner that bore a large red hand. The Band of the Red Hand. The man and banner fell among a group of trollocs eating sizzling pieces of meat around a fire. Sparks flew in all directions, and the enraged beasts yanked the intruder out of the flames, but he was long past caring what they did to him. "Fail," he whispered.
"I see it."
Her bundle concealed the sack with the horn in it. She added, more to herself,
"Light, how are we going to reach Matt?"
They moved off to the side as the rest of her group came through the gateway. They had swords, but carried them bundled up like arrows in packs atop the backs of a few of the men, as if they were tied-up supplies for the battlefield.
"Blood and ashes," Mandevwin whispered, joining the two of them.
Captives whimpered from a pen nearby.
"Maybe they'll put us in there. We could sneak out in the night."
Fail shook her head.
"They'll take our bundles. Leave us unarmed."
"Then what do we do?"
Mandevwin asked, glancing to the side as a group of trollocs passed, dragging corpses harvested from the front lines.
"Start fighting? Hope Lord Matt sees us and sends help?"
Alvar didn't think much of that plan. He wanted to fight, but those trollocs were big. One passed nearby, and its wolf-featured head swung his way. Eyes that could have belonged to a man looked him up and down as if hungry. Alvar stepped back, then reached toward his bundle, where he'd hidden his knife.
"We'll run," Fail whispered once the trolloc passed. "Scatter in a dozen different directions, and in doing so try to disorient them. Maybe a few of us will escape."
She frowned.
"What is delaying Aravine?"
Almost as she said it, Aravine strode through the gateway. The woman in white who had channeled followed her out, and then Aravine pointed at Fail. Fail jerked into the air. Ulver gasped, and Mandevin cursed, throwing down his bundle and digging for his sword, while Arella and Salanda shouted. All three were hauled into the air by weaves moments later, and Aiel in red veils ran through the gateway, weapons out. Pandemonium followed. A few of Fael's soldiers fell as they tried to fight back with their fists. Ulver dove for the ground, hunting for his knife, but by the time he had his hand on its hilt, the skirmish was over. The others were all subdued or tied in air.
So fast, Ulver thought with despair. Why hadn't anyone warned him that fighting happened so quickly?
They seemed to have forgotten him, but he didn't know what to do. Arabin walked up to Fael, still hanging in the air. What was happening?
Arabin. She had betrayed them?
I am sorry, my lady,
Arabin said to Fael. Ulver could barely hear. Nobody paid any attention to him. The Aiel kept watch on the soldiers, shoving them into a group to be guarded. More than a few of their number lay bleeding on the ground. Fael struggled in the air, her face growing red as she strained. Her mouth was obviously gagged. Fael would never remain quiet at a time like this. Arvin untied the horns bag from Fael's back, then checked inside it. Her eyes widened. She pulled the sack tight at the top and held it close.
I had hoped, she whispered to Fael,
to leave my old life behind, to start fresh and new. I thought I could hide, or that I would be forgotten, that I could come back to the light. But the great Lord does not forget, and one cannot hide from him. They found me the very night we reached Andor. This is not what I intended, but it is what I must do.
Arabin turned away.
A horse, she called. I will deliver this package to Lord Demandred myself, as I've been commanded.
The woman in white walked up beside her, and the two started arguing in hushed tones. Ulver glanced about. Nobody was looking at him. His fingers started trembling. He'd known that Trollocs were big, and that they were ugly. But these things were nightmares. Nightmares all around. Oh, light. What would Matt do?
Dovie andi setovia sagain,
Ulver whispered, unsheathing his knife. With a cry, he threw himself at the woman in white and rammed his knife into her lower back. She screamed. Fael dropped free of her bonds of air. And then, suddenly, the captive pens burst open, and a group of yelling men scrambled to freedom.
"Raise it higher!" Doasine cried. "Flaming quickly!" Liana obeyed, weaving earth with the other sisters. The ground trembled in front of them, buckling and slumping like a bunched-up rug. They finished, then used the mound for cover, as fire dropped from upslope. Doasine led the motley bunch. A dozen or so Aes Sedai, a smattering of warders and soldiers. The men clutched their weapons, but lately those had proven about as effective as loaves of bread. The power crackled and sizzled in the air. The improvised bulwark thumped as Sharans pounded it with fire. Liana peeked above the defenses, clutching the one power. She had recovered from her encounter with the forsaken Demondred. It had been an unsettling experience. She'd been totally in his power, and her life could have been snuffed out in an instant. She'd also been unnerved by the intensity of his ravings. His hatred of the dragon reborn was unlike anything she had ever seen. A group of Sharans moved down the slope, and together they sent weaves at the makeshift fortification. Liana sliced one weave from the air, working like a surgeon, cutting away withered flesh. Liana was much weaker in the one power now than she had once been. She had to be more efficient with her channeling. It was remarkable what a woman could achieve with less. The bulwark exploded. Liana threw herself aside as clods of soil rained down. She rolled through curling smoke, coughing and clinging to Sidar. It was those Sharan men. She couldn't see their weaves. She picked herself up, her dress tattered from the explosion, her arms scored by scratches. She caught a hint of blue peeking from a furrow nearby. Doasine. She scrambled over. She found the woman's body there. Not her head, though. Liana felt an immediate, almost overpowering sense of loss and grief. Doacine and she had not been close, but they had been fighting together here. It was wearing on Liana. The loss, the destruction. How much could they take? How many more would she have to watch die? She steeled herself with difficulty. Light. This was a disaster. They had anticipated enemy dreadlords, but there were hundreds upon hundreds of those Sharans, an entire nation's worth of channelers, all trained in war. The battlefield was strewn with bright bits of color, fallen Aes Sedai. Their warders charged up the hillside, screaming in rage at the loss of their Aes Sedai as they were cut down by blasts of the power. Liana stumbled toward where a group of reds and greens fought from a hollowed-out piece of ground on the western slope. The terrain protected them for now, but how long could the women hold out? Still, she felt proud. Outnumbered and overwhelmed, the Aes Sedai kept fighting. This was nothing like the night the Shanshan attacked, when a fractured tower had broken from the inside out. These women held firm. Each time a pocket of them was scattered, they grouped back together and continued fighting. Fire fell from above, but nearly as much flew back, and lightning struck on either side. Liana carefully made her way over to the group, joining Rachin Conneril, who crouched next to a boulder while launching weaves of fire at the advancing Sharans. Liana watched for return weaves, then deflected one with a quick weave of water, making the ball of fire burn away in tiny sparks. Rachin nodded to her. "And here I thought you'd stopped being useful for anything other than batting your eyes at men." "The Damani art is about achieving what you want, Rachin," Liana said coolly, "with as little effort as possible." Rachin snorted and launched a few fireballs toward the Sharans. "I should ask advice from you on that sometime," she said. "If there really is a way to make men do as you like, I should like very much to know it." That idea was so absurd as to nearly make Liana laugh, despite the terrible circumstances. A red? Putting on paints and powders? And learning the Damani arts of manipulation? Well, why not? Liana thought, striking down another fireball. The world was changing, and the Ajahs, ever so subtly, changing with it. The sisters' resistance was attracting the attention of more Sharan channelers. "We'll have to abandon this position soon," Rachin said. Liana only nodded. "Those Sharans," the red growled. "Look at that." Liana gasped. Many of the Sharan troops in this quarter had withdrawn earlier in the fight. Something seemed to have drawn them away. But the channelers had replaced them with a large group of frightened-looking people and were herding them at the front of their line to absorb attacks. Many carried sticks or tools of some sort for fighting, but they bunched together, holding the weapons timidly. "Blood and bloody ashes," Rachin said, causing Liana to raise an eyebrow at her. She continued weaving, trying to send lightning down behind the lines of the frightened people. It still hit many of them. Liana felt sick, but joined in the attacks. As they worked, Manda Wan crawled up to them. Soot-stained and blackened, the green looked horrible. "Probably much as I do," Liana thought, glancing down at her own scratched and sooty arms. "We're pulling back," Manda said. "Maybe we'll have to use gateways." "And go where?" Liana said. "Abandon the battle?" The three grew silent. No, there was no retreat from this fight. It was win here or nothing. "We are too fragmented," Manda said. "We must at least fall back to regroup. We need to bring the women together, and this is the only thing I can think of, unless you have a better idea." Manda looked to Rachin. Liana was too weak in the power now for her opinion to hold much weight. She started cutting down weaves as the two continued to speak in hushed tones. The Aes Sedai nearby began pulling back out of the hollow and moving back down the slope. they'd regroup, make a gateway toward Dashar Nob, and decide what to do next. Wait, what was that? Lyanna sensed powerful channeling nearby. Had the Sharans created a circle? She squinted. They were well into night now, but enough of the landscape burned to give firelight. It also raised a lot of smoke. Lyanna wove air to blow the smoke out of the way, but it lifted on its own, split, as if by a powerful wind. Egwene Alvir strode past them up the slope, glowing with the power of 100 bonfires. That was more than Lyanna had ever seen a woman hold. The Amyrlin walked forward with her hand thrust out, holding a white rod. Egwene's eyes seemed to shine. With a burst of light and force, Egwene released a dozen separate flows of fire. A dozen! They battered the hillside above, throwing the bodies of Sharan channelers into the air. Manda, Lyanna said, I think we have found you a better rallying point.
Talmonis lit a twig off the lantern, then used it to light his pipe. He took one puff before hacking and emptying the pipe's bowl on the rock floor. The tabak had gone bad somehow. Horribly bad. He coughed and ground the offending tabak into the floor with his heel.
You all right, my lord?
Melton asked, walking past, idly juggling a pair of hammers with his right hand as he walked.
I'm still bloody alive, Talmonis said, which is far more than I likely have a right to expect.
Melton nodded without expression and continued on, joining one of the teams working on the dragons. The deep cavern around them echoed with the sounds of hammers on wood as the band did its best to reconstruct the weapons. Talmonis tapped the lantern, judging the oil. It smelled awful when it burned, though he was growing used to that. They had enough for a few more hours yet. That was good, since, so far as he knew, this cavern had no exits to the battleground above. It was accessible only by gateway. Some Ashaman had known of it. Strange fellow. What kind of man knew of caverns that could not be reached except through the One Power? Anyway, the band was trapped down here, in a place of safety but isolation. Only rare bits of information came in Matt's messages. Talmonis strained, thinking he could hear the distant sounds of channelers fighting above, but it was mere fancy. The land was silent, and these ancient stones had not seen the light since the breaking, if then. Talmonis shook his head, walking to one of the working teams.
How goes it?
Denil gestured toward a few sheets of paper Aludra had given him, instructions on how to repair this particular dragon. The woman herself gave precise directions to another of the work teams, her lightly accented voice echoing in the chamber.
Most of the tubes are solid, Denil said. If you think about it, they were built to withstand a little fire and an explosion now and then.
He chuckled, then fell silent, looking at Talmonis.
Do not let my expression dampen your good humor, Talmonis said, tucking his pipe away. Nor let it bother you that we are fighting at the end of the world, that our armies are grossly outnumbered, and that if we lose, our very souls will be destroyed by the Dark Lord of all evil. Sorry, my lord.
That was a joke.
Denil blinked. That?
Yes.
That was a joke?
Yes.
You have an interesting sense of humor, my lord, Denil said.
So I have been told.
Talmonis stooped down and inspected the dragon cart. The scorched wood was held together with screws and extra boards.
This does not seem very functional. It will work, my lord. We won't be able to move it fast, though. I was saying, the tubes themselves fared well, but the carts, well, we've done what we can with salvage and the supplies out of Barillon, but we can only do so much with the time we have.
Which is none, Talmonis said. Lord Matt could call upon us at any moment.
If they're still alive up there,
Denil said, looking upward. A discomforting thought. The band could end its days trapped down here. At least there wouldn't be many of those days. Either the world would end, or the band would run out of food. They wouldn't last a week. Buried here. In darkness. Bloody ashes, Matt. You'd better not lose up there. You'd better not. The band still had fight in them. They were not going to end this one starving underground. Talmanis held up his lantern, turning to go, but noticed something. The soldiers working on the dragons cast a twisted shadow on the wall, like a man with a wide cloak and hat that obscured his face. Denil followed the glance.
Light, it looks like we're being watched over by old Jack himself, doesn't it?
That it does, Talmanis said.
Then in a louder voice he shouted,
It's too quiet in here by far. Let's have some singing, men.
Some of the men paused. Aludra stood up, placing her hands on her hips, and gave him a displeased glance. So Talmanis started it himself.
We'll drink the wine till the cup is dry, and kiss the girls so they'll not cry, and toss the dice until we fly, to dance with Jack of the Shadows.
Silence. Then they started up.
We'll give a yell with a bloody curse, and hug the maids, it could be worse, as we ride away with the Dark One's purse, to dance with Jack of the Shadows.
Their loud voices beat against the stones as they worked, furiously preparing for the part they would play. And they would play it. Talmanis would make certain they did. Even if they had to blast their way out of this tomb in a storm of dragon fire.
As Ulver stabbed the woman in white, Fael's bonds vanished. She dropped to the ground, stumbling but remaining upright. Mandevwin dropped beside her with a curse. Aravin! Light! Aravin! Docile, careful, and capable, Aravin was a dark friend. She had the horn. Aravin glanced at the fallen Aes Sedai that Ulver had attacked, then panicked, grabbing the horse a servant had brought and jumping into the saddle. Fael dashed for her as captives roared out of the nearby pens, throwing themselves at Trollocs and trying to wrestle weapons free. She had almost reached Aravin before the woman galloped away, carrying the horn with her. She headed toward the gentler slopes that would allow her to ride to the top of the heights. No! Fael screamed. Aravin! Don't do this! Fael started to run after her, but saw that that was no use. A horse. She needed a horse. Fael looked around frantic and found the few pack animals they had brought through the gateway. Fael scrambled to Bella's side, cutting free the saddle and all of its burdens with a few swipes of the knife. She leaped up onto the mare bareback and took the reins, then kicked her into motion. The shaggy mare galloped after Aravin, and Fael leaned low on her back. Run, Bella, Fael said. If you've kept any strength back, now is the time to use it. Please, run, girl, run! Bella charged across the trampled ground, hoofbeats accompanying thunder from above. The Trolloc camp was a place of darkness, lit by cook fires and the occasional torch. Fael felt as if she were riding through a nightmare. Ahead, a few Trollocs burst onto the path to head her off. Fael leaned lower, praying to the light that they'd miss when they attacked. Bella slowed, and then two horsemen charged up alongside Fael bearing lances. One pierced a Trolloc's neck, and though the other rider missed his mark, his horse shouldered another Trolloc aside, making way. Bella galloped between the disoriented Trollocs, catching up to two men riding ahead, one large of girth, the other lean. Harnan and Vannin. You too! Fael yelled.
Ho, my lady! Harnan said, laughing.
How?
She yelled at them over the sound of the hooves.
We let a caravan find us, Harnan yelled back, and let them take us captive. They brought us through the gateway a few hours back, and we've been preparing the captives to break free. Your arrival gave us the opportunity we needed.
The horn! You tried to steal the horn!
No, Harnan yelled back. We tried to steal some of Matt's tabak. I thought you had buried it to leave it behind, Vannin yelled from the other side. I figured Matt wouldn't care. He owes me a few marks anyway. When I opened that sack and found the bloody horn of Valir, bloody ashes, I'll bet they heard my yell all the way in Tarvalin.
Fael groaned, imagining the scene. The yell that Fael had heard was a yell of surprise, and it was what had drawn the bear thing to attack. Well, there was no going back to that moment. She clung to Bella with her knees, urging the horse forward. Ahead, Aravine galloped between Trollocs, heading toward where the steep slopes tapered off. Aravine yelled frantically for Trollocs to help her. The racing horses traveled faster than any Trollocs could, however. Demondred. Aravine had said she would take the horn to one of the Forsaken. Fael growled softly, leaning down further, and amazingly Bella pulled ahead of Vannin and Harnan. She didn't ask where they'd found the horses. She directed her entire attention toward Aravine. A cry went up through camp, and Vannin and Harnan split off, intercepting riders who came for Fael. She cut to the side, urging Bella to leap a pile of supplies and charging through the center of a group of people in strange clothing, eating beside a small fire. They yelled after her with thick accents. Inch by inch, she gained on Aravine. Bella snorted and puffed, sweat darkening her coat. The Saldaean cavalry was among the best in the land, and Fael knew horses. She'd ridden all breeds. In those minutes on the battlefield, she would have put Bella up against the Tyran best. The shaggy mare, of no particular breed of note, moved like a champion runner. Feeling the rhythm of the hoofbeats beneath her, Fael slipped a knife from her sleeve. She urged Bella to jump over a small dip in the land, and they hung in the air for a moment, Fael judging the wind, the fall, the moment. She reached her arm back and flipped the knife through the air right before Bella's hooves touched the ground. The knife flew true, burying itself in Aravine's back. The woman slipped from the saddle, crumpling to the ground, sack sliding from her grip. Fael leaped off Bella, landing while still in motion and sliding to a stop beside the sack. She untied the strings that secured its opening and saw the glittering horn inside.
"I'm sorry," Aravine whispered, rolling over. Her legs did not move. "Don't tell Alden what I did. He has such terrible taste in women."
Fael stood up, then looked down with pity. "Pray that the Creator shelters your soul, Aravine," Fael said, and climbed back onto Bella's back. "For if not, the Dark One will have you as his. I leave you to him." She nudged Bella back into motion. There were more Trollocs ahead, and they fixed their attention on Fael. They shouted, and several Myrdral slid forward, pointing toward Fael. They began to shift around her, blocking her path. She set her jaw grim and heeled Bella back in the direction she had come, hoping to meet up with Harnan, Vannin, or anyone else who would help. The camp was abuzz with activity, and Fael picked up riders chasing after her, yelling, "She has the horn of Valir!" Somewhere high atop the hill, Matt Cawthon's forces fought the shadow. So close. An arrow hit the ground beside her, followed by others. Fael reached the captive pens, the broken fence lying in pieces and bodies littered about. Bella was huffing, perhaps at the end of her strength. Fael caught sight of another horse nearby, a roan gelding that was saddled, nudging at a fallen soldier at his feet. Fael slowed. What to do? Switch horses? But then what? She glanced over her shoulder and then ducked down as another arrow passed overhead. She'd picked up some dozen Sharan soldiers on horseback, all chasing her, wearing cloth armor sewn with small rings. They were followed by hundreds of Trollocs. "Even with a fresh horse," she thought, "I can't outrun them." She led Bella behind some supply wagons for cover and leaped off, intending to dash for the fresh mount.
"Lady Fael?"
a small voice asked. Fael glanced down. Alvar huddled beneath the wagon, holding his knife. The riders were almost upon her. Fael didn't have time to think. She whipped the horn from its sack and pushed it into Alvar's arms. "Keep this," she said. "Hide. Take it to Matt Cawthon later in the night."
"You're leaving me?" Alvar asked. "Alone?"
"I must," she said, stuffing some bundles of arrows into her sack, her heart thundering in her chest. "Once those riders pass, find another place to hide. They will come back to search where I've been, after they catch me." She would have to take her knife to herself, lest they torture out of her what she'd done with the horn. She gripped Alvar by the arm. "I'm sorry to place this upon you, little one. There is no one else. You did well earlier. You can do this. Take the horn to Matt, or all is lost." She ran into the open, making the sack she carried obvious. Some of those strangely dressed foreigners saw her, pointing. She lifted the sack high and climbed into the saddle of the roan, then kicked it into a gallop. The Trollocs and Dark Friends followed, leaving the young boy and his heavy burden to huddle beneath a wagon in the middle of the Trolloc camp.
Loghain turned the thin disc over in his fingers, black and white, split by a sinuous line. Quendiar, supposedly. The flakes that rubbed off beneath his fingers seemed to make mockery of its eternal nature.
"Why didn't Taim break them?"
Loghain asked.
"He could have. These are as brittle as old leather."
"I don't know," Andril said, glancing at the others of his team.
"Maybe the time wasn't right yet."
"Break them at the right time and it will help the dragon," said the man who called himself Imaran. He sounded worried.
"Break them at the wrong time, and what?"
"Nothing good, I suspect," Pavara said. "A red."
Would he ever have his vengeance against those who had gentled him? Once, that hatred and it alone had driven him to survive. He now found a new hunger inside of him. He had defeated Aes Sedai, he had beaten them down and claimed them as his own. Vengeance seemed empty. His long-building thirst to kill Mihail filled a little of that emptiness, but not enough. What more? Once he had named himself the Dragon Reborn. Once he had prepared himself to dominate the world, to make it heal. He fingered the seal to the Dark One's prison while standing at the periphery of the battle. He was far to the southwest, below the bogs, where his Ashaman held a small base camp. Distant rumbles sounded from the heights, explosions of weaves firing back and forth between Aes Sedai and Sharans. A large number of his Ashaman fought there, but the Sharan channelers outnumbered the Aes Sedai and Ashaman combined. Others prowled the battlefields, hunting down dreadlords, killing them. He had been losing men faster than the Shadow. There were too many enemies. He held up the seal. There was a power to it. Power to protect the Black Tower somehow?
"If they do not fear us, fear me. What will happen to us once the dragon is dead?"
Dissatisfaction radiated through the bond. He met Gabrella's eyes. She had been inspecting the battle, but now her eyes were upon him. Questioning. Threatening? Earlier, had he really been thinking that he'd tamed Aes Sedai? The idea should have made him laugh. No Aes Sedai could be tamed, not ever. Loghain pointedly placed the seal and its fellows in the pouch at his belt. He drew its strings closed, meeting Gabrella's eyes. Her concern spiked. For a moment, he'd felt that concern of hers to be for him, not because of him. Perhaps she was learning how to manipulate the bond, to send him feelings she thought would lull him. No, Aes Sedai could not be tamed. Bonding them hadn't contained them. It had made more complications. He reached to his high collar, undoing the dragon pin he wore there, and offered it to Andril.
"Andril Genhold,
You have walked into the pit of death itself and returned. Twice now I am in your debt. I name you full Ashaman. Wear the pin with pride.
He had already given the man back his sword pin, restoring him to dedicate it. Andral hesitated, then reached out and took the pin in reverent hands.
And the seals?
Pivara asked, arms folded.
They belong to the White Tower. The Amarlin is their watcher.
The Amarlin, Loghain said, is as good as dead from what I have heard. In her absence, I am a fitting steward.
Loghain seized the source, subjecting it, dominating it. He opened a gateway back to the top of the heights. The war returned to him in full force, the confusion, the smoke and screams. He stepped through, the others following. The powerful channeling from Demandred shone like a beacon, the man's booming voice continuing to taunt the dragon reborn. Randall Thor was not here. Well, the closest thing to him was Loghain himself, another substitute.
I'm going to fight him, he told the others. Gabrilla, you will remain behind and wait for my return, as I may need healing. The rest of you deal with Taim's men and those Sharan channelers. Let no man live who has gone to the Shadow, whether by choice or force. Bring justice to the one and mercy to the other.
They nodded. Gabrilla seemed impressed with him, perhaps for his decision to strike at the enemy's heart. She did not realize. Not even one of the Forsaken could be as powerful as Demandred seemed to be. Demandred had a Saangreal, and a powerful one. Similar in power to Kalandor, maybe stronger. With that in Loghain's hands, many things in this world would change. The world would know of him and the Black Tower, and they would tremble before him as they never had for the Amarlin seat.
Egwene led an assault the likes of which had not been seen in millennia. The Aes Sedai pulled themselves out of their defensive fortifications and joined with her, pushing up the western slope in a steady stride. Weaves flew in the air like an explosion of ribbons caught in the wind. The sky broke with the light of 1,000 bolts, the ground groaning and trembling with the hits. Demandred continued to fire upon the Andorans from the other side of the plateau, and each shot of balefire sent ripples through the air. The ground cracked with spiderwebs of black, but now tendrils of something sickly began to sprout from those cracks. It spread like a disease across the broken stones of the hillside. The air felt alive with the power, the energy so thick that Egwene almost thought the one power had become visible to all. Through this, she drew as much strength as she could hold through Vora's Saangreal. She felt as she had when fighting the Seanchan, only somehow more in control. Then her rage had been fringed by desperation and terror. This time it was a white-hot thing, like a metal heated beyond the point of being worked by a smith. She, Egwene Alvear, had been given stewardship of this land. She, the Amarlin seat, would not be bullied by the Shadow any longer. She would not retreat. She would not bow as her resources failed. She would fight. She channeled air, building a swirling storm of dust, smoke, and dead plants. She held it before herself, obscuring the view of those above as they tried to pinpoint her. Lightning crashed down around her, but she wove earth, digging deeply in the rock and bringing up a spurt of iron that cooled in a spire next to her. The lightning struck at the spire, sparing her as she sent the windstorm howling up the incline. A movement at her side. Egwene felt Lyalwyn nearing. That one had proven faithful. Such a surprise. Having a new warder did not take the edge off her despair at Gawain's death, but it did help in other ways. That knot in the back of Egwene's mind had replaced itself with a new one, very different, yet shockingly loyal. Egwene raised Vora's Saangreal and continued her attacks, moving up the hillside, Lyalwyn at her side. Ahead, Sharans huddled down, weathering the winds. Egwene struck them with ribbons of fire. Channelers tried to attack her through the windstorm, but their weaves went astray, their eyes clogged with dust. Three regular soldiers attacked from the side, but Lyalwyn dispatched them efficiently. Egwene brought the wind around and used it like hands, scooping the channelers up and flinging them into the air. The lightning bolts from above took the men in a fiery embrace, and smoking corpses plummeted to the hillside. Egwene pressed forward, her army of Aes Sedai advancing, flinging weaves like arrows of light. Ashaman joined them. Those had fought alongside the White Tower on and off, but now they seemed committed in force. Dozens of men gathered as she led the way. The air became thick with the One Power. The wind stopped. The dust storm suddenly fell, smothered like a candle beneath a blanket. No natural force had done that. Egwene mounted a rocky outcrop, looking up toward a man in black and red standing at the top, his hand out. She had finally drawn out the one who led this force. His dreadlords fought alongside the Sharans, but she sought their leader, Taim, Mihail. "He's weaving lightning!" a man yelled behind her. Egwene immediately brought up a spire of molten iron and cooled it to draw the lightning that fell a moment later. She glanced at the side. The one who had spoken was Jahar Narishma, Maurice's Ashaman warder. Egwene smiled, looking toward Taim. "Keep the others off me," she commanded loudly. "All but you, Narishma and Maurice. Narishma's warnings will prove useful." She gathered her strength and began to release a storm at the traitor Mihail. Isla picked through the dead on the battlefield near the ruins. Though the fighting had moved downriver, she could hear distant shouts and explosions in the night. She hunted for the wounded among the fallen, and ignored arrows and swords when she found them. Others would gather those, though she wished they would not. Swords and arrows had caused much of this death. Rain, her husband, worked nearby, prodding at each body, then listening for a heartbeat. His gloves were stained red, and blood smeared his colorful clothing, because he had been pressing his ear against the chests of corpses. Once they confirmed someone was dead, they left an X drawn on a cheek, often in the person's own blood, that would keep others from repeating the work. Rain seemed to have aged a decade in the last year, and Isla felt as if she had too. The way of the leaf was an easy master at times, providing a life of joy and peace. But a leaf fell in calm winds and in the tempest. Dedication demanded that one accept the latter as well as the former. Being driven from country after country, suffering starvation as the land died, then finally coming to rest in the lands of the Shan Chan, such had been their life. None of it matched losing Aram. That had hurt far more deeply than had losing his mother to the Trollocs. They passed Morgays, the former queen, who organized these workers and gave them orders. Isla kept moving. She cared little for queens. They had done nothing for her or hers. Nearby, Rain stopped, raising his lantern to examine a full quiver of arrows that a soldier had been carrying as he died. Isla hissed, lifting her skirts up to step around corpses and reach her husband. "Rain!"
"Peace, Isla," he said. "I'm not going to pick it up. Yet. I wonder."
He looked up, toward the distant flashes of light downriver and atop the heights, where the armies continued their terrible acts of murder. So many flashes in the night, like hundreds of lightning bolts. It was well past midnight now. They'd been on this field looking for the living for hours.
"You wonder?" Isla asked.
"Rain."
"What would we have them do, Isla? Trollocs will not follow the way of the leaf."
"There is plenty of room to run," Isla said.
Look at them. They came to meet the Trollocs when the Shadow Spawn were barely out of the Blight. If that energy had been spent gathering the people and leading them away to the south, the Trollocs would have followed, Rain said. What then, Isla? We have accepted many masters, Isla said. The Shadow might treat us poorly, but would it really be worse than we have been treated at the hands of others? Yes, Rain said softly. Yes, Isla, it would be worse. Far, far worse. Isla looked at him. He shook his head, sighing. I am not going to abandon the way, Isla. It is my path, and it is right for me. Perhaps I will not think quite so poorly of those who follow another path. If we live through these times, we will do so at the bequest of those who died on this battlefield, whether we wish to accept their sacrifice or not. He trailed away. It's just the darkness of the night, she thought. He will overcome it once the sun shines again. That's the right of it, isn't it? She looked up at the night sky. That sun. Would they be able to tell when it rose? The clouds lit from the fires below seemed to be growing thicker and thicker. She pulled her bright yellow shawl closer, feeling suddenly cold. Perhaps I will not think quite so poorly of those who follow another path. She blinked a few tears from her eyes. Light, she whispered, something twisting inside. I shouldn't have turned my back on him. I should have tried to help him return to us, not cast him out. Light, oh light, shelter him. Nearby, a group of mercenaries found the arrows and picked them up.
Hey, Hanlon, one called. Look at this.
When the brutish men had originally started helping with the Tuatha An work, she had been proud of them. Avoiding battle to help care for the wounded, the men had seen beyond their violent past. Now she blinked and saw something else about them. Cowards, who would rather pick through corpses and fish in their pockets than fight. Which was worse? The men who, misguided though they were, stood up to the Trollocs and tried to turn them back? Or these mercenaries who refused to fight because they found this path easier? Isla shook her head. She had always felt as if she knew the answers in life. Today, most of those had slipped from her. Saving a person's life, though, that she could cling to. She headed back among the bodies, searching for the living among the dead.
Ulver scuttled back under the wagon, clutching the horn, as Lady Fael rode off. Dozens of riders followed her, and hundreds of Trollocs. It had grown so dark. Alone. He'd been left alone again. He squeezed his eyes shut, but that didn't do much. He could still hear men screaming and shouting in the distance. He could still smell blood, the captives who had been killed by the Trollocs as they tried to escape. Beyond the blood he smelled smoke, thick and itchy. It seemed that the whole world was burning. The ground trembled as if something very heavy had hit it somewhere close by. Thunder rumbled in the sky, accompanied by sharp cracks as the lightning struck time and time again at the heights. Ulver whimpered. How brave, he had thought himself. Now here he was, finally at the battle. He could barely keep his hands from trembling. He wanted to hide, dig deep into the earth. Fael had told him to find another place to hide because they might come back, looking for the horn. Dared he go out there? Dared he stay here? Ulver cracked his eyes open, then nearly screamed. A pair of legs ending in hooves stood beside the wagon. A moment later, a snouted face leaned down and looked at him, beady eyes narrowing, nostrils sniffing. Ulver yelled, scrambling back, clutching the horn. The Trolloc yelled something, heaving the wagon over and nearly smashing it down on Ulver. The wagon's contents of arrows went scattering across the ground as Ulver dashed away, looking for safety. There was none. Dozens of the Trollocs turned toward him, and they called to one another in a language Ulver did not recognize. He looked about, horn in one hand, knife in the other, frantic. No safety. A horse snorted nearby. It was Bella, chewing on some grain leaked from a supply cart. The horse raised her head, looking at Ulver. She didn't have a saddle on, only a halter and bridle.
Blood and ashes, Ulver thought, running for her. I wish I had wind.
This plump mare would end him in a cookpot for certain. Ulver sheathed his knife and jumped up onto Bella's back, seizing the reins in one hand, clutching the horn in the other. The pig-snouted Trolloc from the wagon swung, nearly taking off Ulver's arm. He cried out, kicking Bella into motion, and the mare galloped out from among the Trollocs. The beasts ran behind with howls and yells. Other calls sounded throughout the camp, which was nearly emptying out as they converged on the boy. Ulver rode as he'd been taught, down low, guiding with his knees. And Bella ran. Like, but she ran. Matt had said that many horses were frightened of Trollocs and would throw their rider if forced near them. But this animal did none of that. She thundered right past howling Trollocs, right through the center of the camp. Ulver looked over his shoulder. There were hundreds of them back there, chasing him.
Oh, light!
He'd seen Matt's banner atop those heights, he was sure of it. But there were so many Trollocs in the way. Ulver turned Bella to ride the way Aravin had gone. Perhaps he could round the Trolloc camp and get out that way, then come up the back of the heights. Take the horn to Matt, or all is lost. Ulver rode for all he was worth, urging Bella on.
There is nobody else.
Ahead, a large force of Trollocs cut him off. Ulver turned back the other way, but others approached from that direction, too. Ulver cried out, turning Bella again, but a thick black Trolloc arrow hit her in the flank. She screamed and stumbled, then dropped. Ulver tumbled free. Hitting the ground knocked the air from his lungs and made him see a flash of light. He forced himself to crawl to his hands and knees.
The horn must reach Matrim Cawthon.
Ulver grabbed the horn and found that he was weeping.
I'm sorry,
he said to Bella.
You were a good horse. You ran like wind couldn't have. I'm sorry.
She whinnied softly and drew a final breath, then died. He left her and ran beneath the legs of the first Trolloc that arrived. Ulver couldn't fight them. He knew he couldn't. He didn't unsheathe the knife. He just ran up the steep slope, trying to reach the top from where he had seen Matt's flag fall. It might as well have been a continent away. A Trolloc grabbed at his clothing, pulling him down, but Ulver ripped free, leaving cloth in its thick nails. He scrambled over broken ground and with desperation spotted a little cleft in a rocky outcrop at the base of the slope. The shallow crack looked up at the black sky. He threw himself toward it, then wiggled in, clinging to the horn. He barely fit. Trollocs milled around above him, then began to reach in for him, tearing at his clothing. Ulver whimpered and closed his eyes. Loghain hurled himself through the gateway, weaves already forming before him as he struck at Demandred. The man stood on the smoldering slope that looked over the dried river and toward the failing Ander and Pike formations. The Aiel, Kyrianon, and Legion of the Dragon fought there as well, and all were in danger of being surrounded. The pikes were all but shattered now. It would soon be a rout. Loghain launched twin columns of fire toward Demandred, but Sharans threw themselves in the way, interfering with his attack. Flesh burned away, bones charring to dust. Their deaths gave Demandred time to spin about and lash out with a weave of water and air. Loghain's burst of fire hit that and turned to steam, then boiled away. Loghain had hoped that after so much channeling, Demandred would be weakened. Not so. A complex weave formed in front of the man, a weave such as Loghain had never seen. It made a field that rippled in the air, and when Loghain next attacked, his weave bounced free like a stick thrown against a brick wall. Loghain leaped to the side, rolling as lightning struck from the sky. Shards of rock pelted him as he wove spirit, fire, and earth, slicing at the strange wall. He ripped it down, then lobbed broken bits of stone from the ground to intercept fire from Demandred. A diversion, Loghain thought, realizing the demon-dread had woven something else, more complex, behind the fire. A gateway opened and shot across the ground, opening to a maw of redness. Logan threw himself to the side as the death gate passed, but it left a trail of burning lava. Demondred's next attack was a jet of air that hurled Logan backward toward that lava. Logan desperately wove water to cool the lava. He hit shoulder first, passing a burst of steam that scalded his skin, but he had cooled the lava enough that it formed a crust atop the still molten flow beneath. Holding his breath against the steam, he hurled himself to the side as another series of lightning bolts pulverized the ground where he had been. Those bolts shattered the crust he'd made, reaching into the molten rock. Drops of lava splashed across Logan, searing his skin, burning pocks in his arm and face. He screamed and wove through his rage to send lightning down on his foe. A slice of spirit, earth, and fire cut his weaves from the air. Demondred was just so strong. That Sangreal was incredible. The next flash of lightning blinded Logan, throwing him backward. He hit a patch of broken shale, the points of the rock biting into his skin.
"You are powerful," Demondred said. Logan could barely hear the words. His ears, the thunder. "But you are not Luz Theron."
Logan growled, weaving through his tears, hurling lightning at Demondred. He wove twice, and though Demondred cut one bolt from the air, the other struck true. But what was that weave? It was another that Logan did not recognize. The lightning hit Demondred but vanished, somehow sent down into the ground and dissipated. Such a simple weave of earth and air, but it rendered the lightning useless. A shield rammed between Logan and the source. Through his wounded eyes, he watched the weave for balefire begin in Demandred's hands. Snarling, Logan grabbed a piece of shale from the ground beside him, the size of his fist, and hurled it at Demondred. Surprisingly, the stone hit, ripping skin, causing Demondred to stumble back. The Forsaken was powerful, but he could still make the mistakes of common men. Never focus all of your attention on the one power, despite what Tam had always said. In that moment of distraction, the shield between Logan and the source vanished. Logan rolled to the side, beginning two weaves, one a shield of his own that he did not intend to use, the other a desperate final gateway, the coward's choice. Demondred growled, raising a hand to his face and lashing out with the power. He chose to destroy the shield, immediately recognizing it as the greater risk. The gateway opened and Logan rolled through, letting it snap closed. He collapsed on the other side, his flesh scalded, his arms flayed, his ears ringing, his sight almost gone. He forced himself to sit up, back in the Ashaman camp below the bogs, where Gabrella and the others awaited his return. He howled in anger. Gabrella's concern radiated through the bond. Real concern. He hadn't imagined it. Light.
"Quiet," she said, kneeling beside him. "You fool. What have you done to yourself?"
"I've failed," he said.
Distantly he felt the strikes of Demandred's power begin again as he continued bellowing for Luz Theron.
"Heal me."
"You're not going to try that again, are you?" she said. "I don't want to heal you, only to let you—"
"I won't try again," Logan said, voice ragged.
The pain was horrible, but it paled compared to the humiliation of defeat.
"I won't, Gabrella. Stop doubting my word. He's too strong."
"Some of these burns are bad, Logan. These holes in your skin, I don't know if I can heal them completely. You will be scarred."
"That is fine," he growled.
That would be where the lava had splashed on his arm and the side of his face.
"Light," he thought. "How are we going to deal with that monster?"
Gabrella put her hands on him, and healing weaves poured into his body.
The thunder of Egwene's battle with Mihail rivaled that of the crashing clouds above. Mihail, a new Forsaken, his name proclaimed by his dreadlords across the battlefield. Egwene wove without thought, hurling weave after weave toward the renegade Ashaman. She had not called upon the wind, but still it rushed and roared about her, whipping her hair and her dress, catching her stole and flipping it about. Narishma and Maurice huddled with Lyalwyn on the ground beside her, Narishma's voice, barely audible above the battle, calling out weaves as Mihail crafted them. Following her advance, Egwene stood upon the top of the heights, on even ground with Mihail. She knew somewhere deep that her body would need rest soon. For now, that was an unaffordable luxury. For now, only the fight mattered. Fire flared toward her, and she slapped it aside with air. The sparks caught in the wind, swirling about her in a spray of light as she wove earth. She sent a ripple through the already broken ground, trying to knock Mihail down, but he split the wave with a weave of his own. "He's slowing," she thought. Egwene stepped forward, swollen with power. She began two weaves, one above each hand, and spouted fire at him. He responded with a bar of pure whiteness, wire-thin, which missed her by less than a handspan. The bale fire left an afterimage in Egwene's eyes, and the ground groaned beneath them as the air warped. Those spider webs sprang out across the ground, fractures into nothingness. "Fool!" she yelled at him. "You will destroy the pattern itself!" Already their clash threatened that. This wind was not natural, this sizzling air. Those cracks in the ground spread from Mihail widening. "He's weaving it again!" Narishma cried, voice caught in the tempest. Mihail released this second weave of balefire, fracturing the ground, but Egwene was ready. She sidestepped, her anger building. Balefire. She needed to counter it. "They don't care what they ruin. They are here to destroy. That is their master's call. Break. Burn down. Kill."
"Gawain!"
She screamed in fury, weaving column after column of fire, one after another. Narishma shouted what Mihail was doing, but Egwene couldn't hear for the rush of sound in her ears. She saw soon, anyway, that he had constructed a barrier of air and fire to deflect her attacks. Egwene strode forward, sending repeated strikes at him. That gave him no time to recover, no time to attack. She stopped the rhythm only to form a shield that she held at the ready. A spray of fire off his barrier made him stumble back, his weave cracking, and he raised his hand, perhaps to attempt balefire again. Egwene slammed the shield between him and the source. It didn't quite cut him off, for he held it back by force of will. They were near enough now that she could see his incredulity, his anger. He fought back, but was weaker than she, and perhaps to attempt balefire again. Egwene slammed the shield between him and the source. It didn't quite cut him off, for he held it back by force of will. They were near enough now that she could see his incredulity, his anger. He fought back, but was weaker than she. Egwene pushed, bringing that shield closer and closer to the invisible thread that connected him to the one power. She forced it with all her strength. Mihail, straining, released a small stream of balefire upward through the gap where the shield had not yet fallen into place. The balefire destroyed the weave, as it did the air, and indeed the pattern itself. Egwene stumbled back as Mihail directed the weave toward her, but the white-hot bar was too small, too weak to reach her. It faded away before hitting. Mihail snarled, then vanished, warping the air in a form of traveling Egwene did not know. Egwene breathed deeply, holding her hand to her chest. Light! She had almost been obliterated from the pattern. He disappeared without forming a gateway. The true power, she thought. The only explanation. She knew next to nothing about it. It was the Dark One's very essence. The lure that had coaxed channelers in the Age of Legends to drill the boar in the first place. Balefire. Light. I was almost dead. Worse than dead. She had no way to counter balefire.
It's only a weave. Only a weave. Perrin's words. The moment was past now, and Mihail had fled. She would have to keep Narishma close to warn her if someone started channeling nearby. Unless Mihail uses the true power again. Would another man be able to sense that being channeled? Mother! Egwene turned as Maurice gestured toward where most of the Aes Sedai and Ashaman were still engaged in a resounding battle with the Sharan forces. Many sisters in colorful dresses lay dead across the hillside. Gawain's death haunted her thoughts like an assassin in black. Egwene set her jaw and stoked her anger, drawing in the one power as she launched herself at the Sharans.
Urin, his nostrils stuffed with cloth, fought on Pulaf Heights with the other borderlanders. Even through the cloth he smelled the war. So much violence. The scents of blood, of rotting flesh all around him. They coated the ground, his sword, his own clothing. He had already been ill, violently, several times during the battle. Still, he fought. He threw himself aside as a bear-snouted Trolloc crawled over the bodies and swung down at him. The beast's sword made the ground shake, and Hurin cried out. The beast laughed an inhuman laugh, taking Hurin's cry to indicate fear. It lunged, so Hurin scuttled forward and under its reach, then opened up its stomach as he ran past. The creature stumbled to a stop, watching at its own reeking innards pour out. "Have to buy time for Lord Rand," Hurin thought, backing away, and waiting for the next Trolloc to come over the bodies. They were coming up the eastern side of the heights, the riverside. This steep slope was hard for them to climb. But light, there were so many of them. "Keep fighting. Keep fighting." Lord Rand had come to him, making apologies to him. Well, Hurin would do him proud. The Dragon Reborn did not need the forgiveness of a little thief-taker, but Hurin still felt as if the world had righted itself. Lord Rand was Lord Rand again. Lord Rand would preserve them, if they could give him enough time. There was a lull in the action. He frowned. The beasts had seemed endless. Surely they hadn't all fallen. He stepped cautiously forward, looking over the corpses and down the slope. No. No, they weren't defeated. The sea of beasts seemed near endless still. He could see them by the light of fires below. The Trollocs had paused their climb because they needed to move corpses out of their way on the slope, many of whom had been cut down by Tam's archers. Below them, at the riverbed, the greater army of Trollocs fought Elaine's army. "We should have a few minutes," Lan Mandragoran said to the soldiers from where he sat on horseback. Queen Aleandra rode nearby as well, talking calmly with her men. Two monarchs within sight. Surely they knew how to exercise command. That made Hurin feel better. "They're preparing for a final charge," Lan said. "A push to force us away from the slope so they can fight us up here on even ground. Rest while they clear bodies. Peace favor your swords, friends. The next assault will be the worst one." The next assault would be the worst one? Light? Behind them on the middle of the plateau, the rest of Matt's army continued pressing the Sharan army, trying to push them back to the southwest. If he could do that, and force them down the slope into the Trollocs fighting Elaine's forces, it could create a right mess that Matt could take advantage of. But for the moment, the Sharans were not giving an inch of ground. In fact, they were pushing back Matt's army, which was beginning to founder. Hurin lay back, listening to the moans all around, the distant shouts and ringing of weapons hitting metal, sniffing the stink of violence hanging around him in an ocean of stenches. The worst still to come. Light help them.
Berylaine used a rag to wipe the blood from her hands as she strode into the feast hall of her palace. The tables had been chopped apart for firewood to stoke the enormous hearths at either end of the long room. In place of the furniture lay rows upon rows of wounded. The doors from the kitchens burst open, and a group of tinkers entered, some carrying litters,
and others helping wounded men limp into the room. Light, Berylaine thought. More? The palace was stuffed to bursting with the wounded. No, no, she said, stalking forward. Not in here, the back hallway. We're going to have to start putting them there. Rosil, we have new wounded. The tinkers turned toward the hallway, speaking in comforting tones to the wounded men. Only those who could be saved were brought back. She had been forced to instruct the leaders among the Tuatha'an women as to which types of wounds took too much effort to heal. Better to save 10 men with bad wounds than to expend the same energy trying to rescue one man who clung to life by a single blade of hope. That moment of explanation had been one of the grimmest things she'd ever done. The tinkers continued moving in a line, and Berylaine watched the wounded for glimpses of white clothing. There were white cloaks among them, but not the one she sought. So many, she thought again. The tinkers had no help moving the wounded. Every able-bodied man in the palace, and most women, had gone to the battlefield to fight or help the Camelin refugees gather arrows. Rosil bustled up, her clothing stained with blood that she ignored. She immediately took charge of the wounded, eyeing them for any who needed immediate attention. Unfortunately, the doors to the kitchen burst open at that moment, and a group of bloodied Andorans and Aiel stumbled through, sent by the kinswomen from another area of the battlefield. What followed was near madness, as Berylaine chivied out everyone she had, grooms the elderly, some children as young as 5, to help settle the newcomers. Only the worst of the Aiel came through. They had a tendency to remain on the battlefield as long as they could hold a weapon.